And we will move on to the next case for this morning, which is Jennings against Auto Meter Products. Mr. Lockman.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Doug Jennings, the plaintiff below and the appellate in this court, brought an action against the defendants for the corruption of federal agency proceedings in the United States Patent and Trademark Office. His complaint had six counts. Counts 1 and 2 were federal racketeering influence and corrupt organization RICO claims. Count 3 was an Indiana state RICO claim. Counts 4 through 6 were Indiana state law claims in fraud, conversion, and theft.
Before you go on, can you tell us the status of Jennings' patent application? Has anything changed since the briefs were filed?
No, ma'am. It is still pending before the Patent and Appeals Board, and we're expecting that the matter will be taken up. It's been docketed, but it should be taken up probably the middle of this year, we hope. The magistrate judge below.
Well, again, before you go on, I have to say, reading everything in this case, it certainly looks like a dispute about granting a patent, whether it was Mr. Jennings' right to the utility patent or whether it was the appropriateness of the design patent being granted. And turning a patent dispute into a RICO claim is what bothers me about your case, frankly. I mean, I'm having trouble seeing this as anything more than just a dispute about patents.
Well, it's not a dispute about patents. It's a dispute about the corruption of the examination function of the United States Patent Office.
Well, you wouldn't care about that if the patent, you know. Well, let's, backing up, and you cite Walker Process a number of times. Fraud in the patent office is one reason that you might find patent misuse, for example. But in the realm of the world of patent law, there are ways of addressing that. You can claim that a certain patent is unenforceable because of that kind of misuse. You can bring a declaratory judgment. If, for example, Mr. Jennings wanted to license his invention, he might need to bring a declaratory judgment to show that the other design patent didn't in any way stand in his way. They're patent-related remedies, and RICO, we've said many times, really isn't an all-purpose statute for every problem, even if there was a misrepresentation before the patent examiner, a point about which I realize, you know, the parties have disagreed.
Well, there's a number of points, if I may address on that. First, Walker Process is a case where there are other manufacturers that are being sued for patent infringement, and they respond with the charge of inequitable conduct so that the patent cannot be enforced against
them. Right, that's the patent misuse doctrine.
Mr. Jennings can't do that here because Mr. Jennings is not a manufacturer. Mr. Jennings was the first inventor of this product.
But you don't have to be a manufacturer to use. You know, patents give you the right to make, use, and sell, and using is something that can happen in many ways, and including licensing, I would assume. But many patents are used by licensing.
I'm sorry. I would disagree that a patent would make it possible to use. You can get a patent on something that infringes someone else's rights, patent rights. A patent is an exclusionary right. It allows you to prevent others from making, using, and selling. And you can only bring a DJ action if you are under a reasonable anticipation of litigation being against you. So that means you have made, used, or sold the invention that's covered by someone else's patent.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, Mr. Jennings can't do that because he's not the manufacturer, so he can't bring an action.
But you're assuming that only manufacturers have standing to sue in patent
cases. Sorry if I gave that impression. Someone that also uses it could also be someone that could be sued, but there would have to be a reasonable anticipation of litigation to meet the test for jurisdiction in a declaratory judgment action.
That's certainly correct as an abstract matter. I'm just skeptical that Mr. Jennings could never be in that kind of position. And in some ways, this is a bit beside the point because he has to have a RICO claim before he can go forward in a RICO suit, even if there were no other remedies. I'm not sure that there are no other remedies. But how can you get over the fact that there is just such a it's such a closed-end, small time frame, single victim kind of case. You can't say the whole public is victimized, can you?
Well, I can't say that the public is victimized in cases where there's a loss of the honest services of a government official. That's going on in the courts in the Northern District of Illinois right now.
But why does RICO cover that? Where's his property loss if the government official is, go ahead.
If you're talking about his property loss for the standing for RICO, it's governed by the Indiana statute. And there's at least five subsections of that Indiana statute defining property that are affected by his proceedings in the patent office. The main reason that this is a RICO case is that this is the tampering and the corrupt influence of federal agency proceedings.
That's not necessarily the remedy for that, but go back to property for a minute and explain what his property loss is here.
He has, under the Indiana state statute, he has, number one, a loss of patent term. And that's going to occur even if he's granted a patent. It's assured that he will either lose the entire patent rights if the board goes against him, or if the board grants him a patent, he's going to lose at least 1 year and 124 days in his patent term.
All right, but let's take each of those. If the board rules against him and the ground is perhaps that it's obvious, not anything about prior art, but it's an obviousness ground, then none of this makes any difference. The board would have simply come to its own decision, which it's entitled to. Your opponents point out that your year and some period of time assumes that he instantaneously would have been granted a patent without any time for examination. Surely there must be some reasonable time period in which any application is examined. That was the decision. When we went from a date of filing, to a date of filing system for patent law from date of invention, we built in a longer patent period so as to give the examiner time to examine.
And an examiner had examined in this particular case. Mr. Jennings' patent application was filed in October of 2000. It had been under review for almost 2 years. It had gone through one office action, and he had responded and successfully rebutted the examiner's first case. The examiner was at her wit's end. In the appendix, pages 87 to 90, demonstrate that she is using the department inside the patent office for obtaining prior art, and they haven't been able to give her the prior art to reject Mr. Jennings' claim. She goes outside the patent office. And under 18 U.S.C. 1001, these defendants had a duty to tell the truth to an examiner. They lied to her. They lied to her on the telephone. They sent her false evidence. Consequently, they have corrupted federal agent proceedings. This is a great RICO case. Mr. Jennings is an individual inventor. There are three companies. One copied his invention and then had the audacity to file for their own patent application on it. They had to submit false evidence to get that patent application.
Well, you're conflating a lot of things in this record, I think. First of all, I recognize, again, that there is some debate about how much of an overlap there is between the utility patent that he wanted and the design patent that the other party received. They don't coincide perfectly. I mean, if you like Venn diagrams, maybe, yes, there is an overlap in subject matter and use, but they're not exactly the same thing. And maybe in some instances you can get a design patent and not a utility patent, and maybe sometimes it's the other way around. I don't know. Secondly, you act as though the examiner was on some kind of vendetta even before Autometer Products becomes involved, to find some reason to deny the patent, and I don't know why you would make such an assumption. The examiner has the duty to see if there's prior art. So
yes,
she examines, and she appropriately looks in the files, and she appropriately contacts other people. What's wrong with that?
And she has a reasonable expectation because of 18 U.S.C. 1001 that the public will respond to her with the truth. When they don't, we have tampered agency proceedings. We either have tampered evidence before that federal agency, or we have corrupt influence.
So you should just challenge the patent. You should say that the patent was invalidly granted.
We're talking about, there's two things.
I mean, honestly, to see RICO as a case, every time somebody thinks that misinformation has been given to a federal agency, we're going to have a RICO case about it. It's going to keep us very busy.
And that won't happen if this case is allowed to go forward. And the reason is there are multiple schemes involved.
I'm having a hard time finding. I only see one victim, one scheme, and one type of injury. I mean, however you try to dance around and make it, how do you get around one victim? And when you talk about, you know, you name some other victims like taxpayers and market competitors, but nobody is named specifically.
No, ma'am, they're not named specifically, but they are identifiable from the complaint. Particularly, there are competitors who make aftermarket instrument cluster bezels that would be covered by the patent that the defendants fraudulently obtained. Those six people are identifiable in the notice that's in paragraph, I think it's 62, 61 of the complaint. Mr. Jennings gave notice to them of his provisional rights. That means that there are letters, there are documents that identify those six competitors. And so they are people that are injured by having a market barrier from the defendants that they shouldn't have in place. There are also two examiners that can be identified from the public record. One is examiner Lum on Mr. Jennings' application. The other one is the examiner of Mr. Day's patent application. I don't recall his name right now, but it's in the record. Those are additional victims. And also in cases regarding honest government, the public can be determined to be a victim, and this court has said so in U.S. versus Spano, which it decided last year. So the public generally, because there are federal agencies involved, the six competitors who now have to consider the public notice effect of patents, and the two examiners that were duped in both of these, and Mr. Jennings. So there are a number of victims in this case, as well as two goals. The defendants came together. They have a partnership, as alleged in paragraph 12. They have a partnership, and in that they had a two-pronged assault. The first one, when the examiner called them, and they became aware of the application that Mr. Jennings had on his aftermarket instrument cluster bezel, they then proceeded to give false evidence and false testimony to that examiner by wire so that they could prevent him from getting a patent. That has an advantage for their enterprise. They don't have to worry about him coming back and getting a license from them. A mere 11 days later, they file for their own patent application that they know they're not entitled
to.
Well,
I think that you're drawing an inference there. I want to go back to this, your attempt to rely on loss of honest government services. You would agree, would you not, that under 1964C, a private party has standing to bring a RICO claim for injury in his business or property?
Yes, ma'am.
Right. So why is anything that happens inside the patent office or a government office his business or property? These are all lines that we try to draw to make sure that litigation is focused in the appropriate way.
And the property loss is determined with reference to the Indiana property
statute. But you can't then bring in this loss of government services as something that's relevant.
Yes, ma'am, because, well, on two bases. One is the loss of the honest services of government officials allows us to allege that mail fraud and wire fraud occurred, because 1346, which regards the intangible of honest services, is what enables us to allege the mail fraud and wire fraud as part of the RICO action. Additionally, the loss of intangibles under subsection 3 of the Indiana statute, which is IC 3541-1-23, says that intangibles can be considered property under Indiana law.
Well, intangibles, of course, can be considered property, and there are all sorts of intangible rights, but the hope that you might someday get a patent based on an application is a hope or an expectation. It's not something that's an intangible right.
I agree with you, but the expectation that I'm going to get reliable examination of that application at the patent office without tampered evidence and without corrupt influence from people that are invited into the examination is an intangible that I'm entitled to.
Well, but I'm not sure that you're entitled to bring a private suit over that. Now, you certainly, citizens, I hope, do have an expectation of honest government services. If they think they haven't received that, they can complain to the U.S. attorneys or they can complain to other appropriate agencies. It doesn't necessarily mean that there is a private right of action for damages for that kind of loss, if you will, that kind of misfunctioning of the government system. And the Supreme Court has been extremely clear that we don't just have private actions for everything.
I agree.
Even in RICO, they've been very clear about that. They've narrowed RICO over and over again.
And I agree, and I think that this is a different case because we have a uniquely situated plaintiff. We have the denial of his patent rights through corrupt proceedings.
I don't see what's so unique about him at all. I mean, patents are very contentious things sometimes. They're interference proceedings when people want to say, you know, one patent or another should be granted. There are competitors who have strong interests, perhaps, in patents not being granted. I think it would be the most routine of things for people to complain about misinformation being furnished to an examiner.
But there, what we have here is we have the individual that actually invented something who is having outside people interfere with the examination of that application, at the same time pursuing their own goal of getting a patent on that. And Mr. Jennings is an individual inventor. He is looking at a way of trying to stop these people from both the offense of taking his property and the defense of interfering with his proceedings so he can get a patent.
Did he ever submit anything to the patent office indicating that his bezel was prior art that was relevant to the design patent application?
No, ma'am, because he didn't know about the design patent application.
Yeah, but he knows about it now, for sure. I mean, he could file something now, couldn't he?
That's correct. But all that would do is determine whether that patent was validly issued or not. It wouldn't redress any loss that he might have from that. It wouldn't redress,
well, it would redress a lot of loss. It means that if his patent was, in fact, prior art, then if he wins on his appeal, he doesn't have the design patent to work around. He can go forward with his patent.
No, I'm sorry. If he wins on his appeal, the design patent is still there. He gets his patent.
I understand that. But if he had tried to challenge the design patent also and had showed that his was prior art because of what was on his website, because of the fact that his, I mean, that's what the examiner was trying to find out, basically, was there prior art, he might get a lot of what he's looking for here. Obviously not the damages, but that's a different matter.
Well, he wouldn't be able to get his recovery for the racketeering activities. I see that I'm out of time.
Right. You're in your rebuttal time if you'd like to save the rest of
your... Yes, I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. All right. We'll next hear from Mr. Brothers.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is a bezel, by the way. This is an example. It's hard to figure out from the briefs. Of an aftermarket bezel with an instrument gauge in it. And this is what auto enthusiasts buy. My client Autometer has been in business for 50 years and has been selling these kind of aftermarket bezels in its catalog since the 1990s. The allegations that are set forth here do not, as the district court correctly found, justify a RICO case. The court found that there were two independent grounds for dismissing the RICO claims. One is that it was a one-shot scheme, that there was no pattern, and the other is that there was no threat of continuing criminal activity. Each of those independently are sufficient to dismiss this case. It is significant in reading the amended complaint that Jennings admits that his application was filed in October of 2000, 6 months before that. He admits in paragraph 14 of his amended complaint, my client was publicly offering for sale the bezel.
Could you clarify something for me? Maybe I should have asked Mr. Lockman this, but I take it that everybody agrees that at this show back in March, was that when it was?
That's right.
The bezel was out there. I mean, people could see it.
Yes. Our client's bezel was out there.
Your client's bezel was out there. And so even if after the examiner in October, isn't it October that they make the request for whether the bezel was available or not?
October, the application was filed on October 25th, 2000, and on October 21st, 2001, mm-hmm. the examiner contacted our client saying, do you have any information about this?
And that's when the flyer is sent.
The flyer was sent on October 31st.
And the date of the flyer is immediately before the patent examiner's request?
The date of the flyer is October 24, 2000, which is, it was before the application was filed. It was a year before the examiner's request.
Okay, and was the date on the flyer also before the show?
No, the show was 6 months prior to this specific flyer.
So I guess what I've been confused about is why do we care about the date on the flyer if, in fact, everybody agrees that your client's bezel was out there at the show anyway, 6 months before?
The only reason is because Mr. Jennings has included that date in his amended complaint. What happened was Mr. Jennings filed his initial complaint and mm-hmm. Had seen this flyer, and he was believing that this flyer had been ginned up somehow 2 years later. And then after some discovery, he filed his amended complaint after seeing that, in fact, the show acknowledging finally that it was shown publicly. And 6 months later, this flyer was part of a supplemental catalog that my client had put out. So he included that in his dates, but there's a tension within the amended complaint because everyone admits, as he has in paragraph 14 of his amended complaint, that this was publicly available 6 months before the date of that flyer. So Your Honor is correct. That ultimately is the date of that flyer particularly relevant? No, I don't think so, because everyone agrees that in March of 2000, 6 months before that flyer, the product was being publicly offered for sale. But as the court has observed, this is a one-shot scheme. It is closed-ended. And the scheme ended when the examiner denied the application for the patent. And that occurred on February 22nd of 2004. And just as in Midwest Grinding or in Gamboa versus Velez, and Gamboa was a five-year time period alleged of wrongful conduct leading to alleged misconduct by the police force. And this court said even a five-year time period after these people had been tried and acquitted, the scheme was over. Here, the scheme was over once the patent was denied. That is the only injury that is being complained of, Mr. Jennings' inability to get a patent.
What's your response? I know you have a little bit in your briefs to Mr. Jennings' concern that there is simply no remedy for him if the Day patent was erroneous, you know, or wrongfully issued on the basis of fraudulent information or what have you.
Mr. Jennings has three remedies. First of all, with respect to the Day patent, if he so chooses, he can proceed with an action. Now, he claims that he does not have a sufficient reasonable apprehension to bring a declaratory judgment action, which in my mind suggests that, in fact, that it is a completely separate, it's unrelated, as the district court so found, the Day patent from the Jennings patent. With respect to his own application, it is before the Board of Appeals. If the Board of Appeals affirms the denial of the patent on whatever grounds it chooses, whether obviousness or anticipation or otherwise, Mr. Jennings has two remedies. He can, if he so chooses, under 35 U.S.C. 145, take his action to the D.C. District Court, and he can have a complete trial and findings of fact on the actions of the Patent Office. And he can have all of his allegations aired at that time.
And that trial would include any claims that there was fraudulent information being submitted to the examiner or anything?
It would be a new trial on the merits of whatever allegedly wrongful conduct occurred. And that is provided by federal law in 35 U.S.C. 145. If Mr. Jennings believes that there was only errors of law made, he can choose to bring the denial of the of his application to the Federal Circuit, and that's pursuant to 35 U.S.C. 141. He has the choice. He has the option, depending on what he chooses to do after the board makes its decision.
And how do you respond to his argument that it was specific enough to identify certain victims by generally alleging in his complaint the competitors?
The fact is that no competitors were identified in the amended complaint. And to this day, I don't know who these competitors are. And his theory of the damage, as much as I try, all I can figure out is that these other victims were somehow damaged. These competitors were damaged because Mr. Jennings didn't obtain a patent, so these other competitors were deprived of their right to pay royalties to Mr. Jennings, and that's an injury.
Maybe he's saying, though, that they're damaged because Mr. Day did get a patent, and they have to do something vis-a-vis you or Mr. Day, you know.
Well, first of all, the design patent and the utility patent are completely unrelated. They are Mr. Day's patent was for a bezel on a Mustang, a Ford Mustang, and Mr. Jennings' patent was for a Honda or an Acura. Being made by the same company. And
so Mr. Day's patent wouldn't work on a Honda. I mean, he can't somehow generalize it to other car models.
Well, a design patent is specific to that product and to that specific design. And we've cited in our briefs the Karman Industries case pointing out that design and utility patents are based on completely different statutory provisions. They involve different subject matter. The district court correctly ruled that the two were completely unrelated. It is, and the injection of Mr. Day's design patent was added in the amended complaint when Mr. Jennings saw our original motion to dismiss the original complaint and realized he needed to find some other type of scheme, and this was the best that he could come up with. But as a matter of law, they are completely unrelated.
But as a practical matter, I mean, they're both about these automobile aftermarket parts. I mean, it's the same thing, and I guess there's some factual overlap, surely.
Well, the fact that they are both forms of bezels.
Yeah.
So it's the same subject matter, but again, one is a utility patent, one is a design patent, and utility patents are for the mechanical structure. They're for the function of an invention, when a design patent is just an ornamental or an aesthetic design, and that is set forth in the Karman Industries case, and they are under completely separate proceedings, and they provide different forms of protection. And
so if Mr. Jennings got his patent and you wanted to make something like that for a Mustang, would you have to have a license from both Mr. Jennings and the right somehow or another to use Mr. Day's patent?
Well,
have the Day patent.
Yeah, our view would be that his patent, if issued, not only could it later be challenged for being obvious or anticipated, but assuming it was issued, it would cover the scope of the invention, which is for a specific type of function for a specific application, which is for a Honda or an Acura. Now, Mr. Jennings might disagree with me. He has asserted that he wants to get royalties from all of the bezels that Autometer sells.
I thought he wanted royalties for all of the bezels that had a space for additional gauges, was the impression I got from reading the briefs.
Yeah, I mean, that's what he would like to have. And our view would be that that would be an inappropriate application of his patent because the patent is limited by the scope of his claims, and all he was claiming was with respect to his invention, which related to the Honda or to the Acura. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll defer the rest of my time to my co-counsel.
Okay. Thank you. You're right.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Brian Wright, and I represent GageWorks and Mr. Greg Day. I'm also a licensed patent attorney. Have been so for some 15 years. The one thing I'd like to talk to the court about is the reasonable inferences in this case. When Mr. Lockman addressed the court, he said, the examiner called Mr. Day, and they became aware of Jennings' application. That is an unreasonable inference. The federal law requires examiners to maintain strict confidentiality of all applications. Even after they're published, they can only disclose certain information about applications on the direction of the director. So for
the PTO director, you mean?
Correct.
Yeah.
So when Greg Day, sitting in his office one day, received a telephone call from the patent examiner, he didn't know who was involved. He didn't know what was involved. He didn't know why he was involved. He was asked to provide some information about a commercial product. He's invented over 300 commercial products sold by Autometer. This is but one of them.
Could I ask you whether that phone call, I just forget the time sequence, came before or after Mr. Jennings chose to make his application public?
I don't recall the publication date. An applicant doesn't choose to make it public. I mean, they can request early publication, but normally an application is published about 18 months after it's filed.
But he has some reference in his brief, though, to paying some fee
He may have requested early publication.
So I just was wondering if his application had, in fact, been published at that point, then it would not have been inappropriate, I assume, for the examiner to have said, here's a published application.
Well, what the examiner said, I don't know. And I don't know the record on when it was published versus when the examiner called. I will say the examiner called because the Autometer products were disclosed to the examiner as related art to Mr. Jennings' bezel.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a natural thing, the examiner
just
called.
Just follow up, yeah.
So my point is that this whole case is based on really an unreasonable inference. Greg Day didn't know about Mr. Jennings. I'm told it was published in 304, March of 04, which would be well after the examiner called.
Oh, okay.
So he didn't know about this case until he was sued. And for the plaintiff to infer that he had some grand design, it's ridiculous. It's totally meritless.
Let me ask you this question. This is kind of more of a basic, CivPro 1 kind of question. This is a RICO case, and the underlying predicate offenses are wire fraud and mail fraud. I assume that triggers something like the Rule 9B standard of pleading specificity, but I wondered whether you had a view on that. Whether we're in a notice pleading regime here, whether we're on 9B or what we're doing. That may have something to do with whether the competitors had to be named, as Judge Williams was asking about.
Well, I think that he has to be specific in naming victims.
And where does that requirement come from?
I believe 9B would cover it, but the case law I've read has mm-hmm. said specific, you need to be specific, just a general allegation of the public. But again, what Mr. Jennings is asking this court to do is to affirm his right to be a patent troll. He never intends to manufacture.
We can use names. People accumulate patents all the time in this country, and there's nothing illegal about that. You can have that, and you can be in the licensing business.
Sir,
and
sir, I represent some, Your Honor.
Well, okay, so I don't need to tell you.
The point is, though, that Mr. Jennings is free to make bezels all he wants. He could be out there manufacturing and making money. There's nothing in the world preventing him from making a living making bezels.
Could he license the design of a bezel for something other than a Mustang?
Well, if Mr. Jennings were to get a design patent, certainly.
And what about the utility patent that he wants? What rights? How far do you think that will take him?
To me, it's an analogy would be a lamp. Let's say lamps are well known in the art. Bezels are well known in the art. And getting utility on a patent on a lamp would be virtually impossible today. Yet you could get any number of design patents.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's that simple. If he were to get a utility patent on a aftermarket gauge bezel, he would effectively have a closed-in monopoly for a period of time, for 20 years, on that utility, that function. I don't think there's a prayer in the world they'll ever get it because they've been holding gauges for decades, if not.
Yeah, I was going to ask how long your client has been making bezels.
Well, this was the first, and I think the only bezel he's ever made.
Mm-hmm.
It's not in the record, but if I recall correctly, this would have been in 1999. So, Your Honor, we would ask the court to affirm the trial judge. We think he got it exactly right, and we appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Lockman?
A couple of points. This is not a one-ended, close-ended, one-shot deal. The examination of Mr. Jennings' application is still going forward, and there will be one more crime, and it's not mail fraud, it's not wire fraud. It's the tampering or presenting tampered evidence in a federal agency proceeding. When the board picks up the file and considers this false, fabricated reference, there will be one more crime committed. So it is open-ended continuity that's before the court.
Could you explain, following up on the question I asked Mr. Brothers, how that brochure that was furnished could possibly have meant anything when, in fact, the bezel was shown in the trade show back 6 months earlier?
If that was the only thing that happened, we would never have brought this case.
So in other words, that's a nothing. I mean, we should just disregard
the
fact that that brochure happens to have a date of October 2000 on it.
No, it's false evidence.
Why is it false if everybody knows that the thing was out there 6 months before?
Because that piece of evidence was tampered with by changing a date on it.
But how do we know that? I mean, maybe they just printed it off. Maybe that was a supplemental catalog.
It's an allegation in the complaint, but we base it on information that we've got in third-party discovery that it wasn't even picked up from the printers until 3 days after that date. So that is a false piece of evidence, and if it was the only thing they had submitted, but they overreached. When the examiner called back, they present another piece of fabricated evidence.
These are serious charges. I think that it's, the fact that it was picked up at the printer doesn't necessarily mean it was fabricated. Many people keep things electronically. They print them out as need be. I'm not sure that one has to jump to that conclusion.
But we are getting into the issues that would be of proof in the case and not in a proper evaluation under 12b-6.
Anyway, if you'd like to sum up, that would be.
Well, Your Honors, we would argue that there is a multiple scheme here, that there are multiple victims and multiple injuries, and there's been corruption of federal agency proceedings, and we think it was properly brought by this private attorney general in this RICO action.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case.